This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 20th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, violence in Syria sends tens of thousands into Kurdistan, adding to an already severe refugee crisis. Press freedom advocates raise concern about a crackdown on the media after the partner of Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald is detained, and an editor from the paper discloses threats from British officials. And we'll go to Israel, where Bedouin communities in the Negev Desert warn that their way of life is threatened by new development plans. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Students were evacuated from an elementary school in Georgia today when gunshots were reportedly fired in the school. All students are accounted for and no injuries were reported. Police officials say they have a suspect in custody. A court in Pakistan indicted former military dictator Pervez Musharraf today in the assassination of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. From Pakistan, Malik Ayub Sumbal reports.
It's first time in the history of Pakistan that a military dictator has been charged with a criminal act. An anti-terrorism court in Rawalpindi formally indicted former military dictator Pervez Musharraf along with six others in the 2007 murder of Benazir Bhutto, the former Prime Minister of Pakistan. Bhutto was killed in a bomb and bullet fire attack during a political rally following her return from exile. She twice served as a Prime Minister in the 1980s and again in the 90s. Musharraf appeared in court today and denied all charges. He is being kept on house arrest at his Islamabad farmhouse. Malik Ayub Sumbul, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
The White House said today the U.S. has not suspended aid to Egypt, but Deputy Spokesperson Josh Earnest said that a review of the $1.5 billion of military and economic support is ongoing.
We have been pretty forthcoming about what our policy is here. We announced publicly the delay in the F-16s. The president himself announced publicly the cancellation of the joint military exercises. The president himself publicly directed his administration to conduct a broader review of our aid and assistance to Egypt. And that aid and assistance is ongoing, and no determination or conclusion of that review has been reached at this point.
Police in Egypt arrested the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood today, and he is scheduled to stand trial Sunday on charges that include inciting the murder of eight protesters in June. Officers detained Mohamed Badieh near Rabah Square, where hundreds of protesters were killed last week. Attacks on journalists continue in the region. Al-Ahram reports that reporter Tamer Abdul Rauf was shot and killed last night by security forces while returning home after an interview. Security officials say he and a colleague violated curfew, but journalists are exempt from the restriction. Protests continued today in cities across the country, including Cairo and Giza. A California judge has ruled that the state can force feed some prisoners on hunger strike. Christina Unistad has more.
136 prisoners are refusing meals in the second month of a prison hunger strike in California. State officials claim some of the prison hunger strikers were coerced into refusing food and asked a judge to allow the state to force feed some of the inmates when they are deemed to be near death, even if they've signed do not resuscitate orders. The court said the state can ignore the stated wishes of hunger strikers who signed the statements during or just before they began fasting. Critics call the state's move torture on top of torture. The prisoners are protesting the state's use of solitary confinement. In some cases, inmates have been locked up in a small room for 23 hours a day for more than 20 years. The strike began 2 months ago. One inmate hunger strike participant has already died. The New England Journal of Medicine called the force feeding practice of inmates at Guantanamo Bay on a hunger strike medically unethical. California Correctional Healthcare Services spokesperson Liz Grancy says no inmates will be immediately force-fed, but will be done based on medical evaluations and at the discretion of doctors. Christina Onnested, FSRN, California.
And if the natural resources of the earth were a bank account, as of today, we'd be overdrawn. That's the message of Earth Overshoot Day. FSRN's Liam Moriarty explains.
According to the Oakland-based Global Footprint Network, humans are currently using natural resources at 1.5 times the Earth's annual capacity to regenerate them. And this year, as of August 20th, humanity has used up its yearly allotment. Not surprisingly, highly developed economies use way more than their share. Europe uses more than 2.5 times its annual regeneration capacity, the U.S. more than 4 times. And increasingly, those economies are exporting their ecological footprint to poor countries. Philippe Carr, with the World Wildlife Fund Europe in Brussels, points to a recent EU study showing that from 1990 to 2008, an area of forest 3 times the size of Belgium was cut down in developing countries to grow crops exported to Europe. He says the lesson for nations trying to reduce their impact is clear.
That it's not just good enough to look at what they produce on their own soil. They also have to look at what's being produced for them or being exported to them by other countries.
As the pace of global resource consumption speeds up, Earth Overshoot Day has been getting earlier. Just 6 years ago, consumption broke even on October 20th. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Press freedom advocates are raising concerns after law enforcement in the UK targeted The Guardian for its coverage of mass government surveillance. Watchdogs and journalists say the detention of reporter Glenn Greenwald's partner under a terrorism law and forcing the newspaper to destroy hard drives containing the files leaked by Edward Snowden are a form of intimidation. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
In his first interview following a 9-hour detention at London's Heathrow Airport on Sunday, David Miranda told The Guardian that British police confiscated his computer, external hard drive, video game player, and cell phone. He was not allowed to call his partner, Glenn Greenwald, or answer questions through an interpreter, even though the Brazilian national's first language is Portuguese. Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger denounced Miranda's treatment on BBC Radio Tuesday, revealing that it came after months of pressure from the British government to stop publication of leaked documents about US and UK surveillance programs. He said this included phone calls from officials who told him, "You've had your debate, there's no need to write anymore."
We had some contact with the government who were keen to get the material back, and that conversation went on for a number of weeks. And then culminated in the government threatening legal action unless we handed it back or destroyed it.
The newspaper chose to destroy it rather than surrender the documents to the government. Rusbridger said two government communications headquarters officials came to The Guardian's offices to oversee the destruction of hard drives containing copies of Snowden's documents.
Given that there were other copies and we could work out of America, which has better laws to protect journalists, I saw no reason not to destroy this material ourselves rather than hand it back to the government.
In light of these incidents, along with revelations The Guardian and other outlets have published about the scope of government surveillance, aided by companies like Google, Microsoft, and Apple, privacy advocates are researching how both reporters and members of the public can protect their personal information. Jeff King with the Committee to Protect Journalists is one of many experts recommending free open-source encryption software, which can be used to secure both online communications and stored files. Edward Snowden used encryption programs to communicate with reporters, and Greenwald said the hard drives confiscated from Miranda are also encrypted. Most of these programs require users to come up with a personal key that they can share with specific people to decode the text.
Of course, encryption is useless if you have your password as password 1234, right? And it's sort of a surprising number of folks set passwords that can be easily guessed, not necessarily by a person, right, but by a computer running a program and going through the dictionary and adding numbers and subtracting numbers, that kind of thing.
King and other press freedom advocates also recommend the program Tor, which hides a user's IP address, which can be used to determine his or her physical location, and the program Off the Record, which can encrypt online chat programs like GChat that are vulnerable to government surveillance. Seth Schoen with the Electronic Frontier Foundation says no program can completely protect someone from government surveillance, but these and other steps can make it much more difficult than it currently is for the government to sweep up information.
There's really so much that we don't know about capabilities of various people who are trying to spy on us, whether that's the U.S. government or the Chinese government or organized crime or anyone. People shouldn't be misled into thinking that if they just install a couple of apps, then there's no possible way that the U.S. government could ever get into their computer. There's this risk that if someone particularly wants to spy on you, there are probably vulnerabilities in your software and your devices that would allow them to put spyware on those devices. Now, that said, there's this difference between mass surveillance and targeted surveillance. And we may really be able to deploy a lot more encryption and protect against mass surveillance.
Users looking for a more secure email program have fewer options now, following decisions by LavaBit and Silent Circle to shut down their encrypted email services. And the tech legal news and discussion site Grok Law announced Tuesday that it's shutting down completely. Grok Law's founder wrote a final post citing the revelations of mass NSA surveillance and said, "I don't know how to function in such an atmosphere." Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Violence in Syria is driving one of the largest cross-border migrations since the conflict began. Nearly 30,000 refugees have crossed into northern Iraq in the past week. At a makeshift tent in Kurdistan, refugees wait to be registered. The majority of those crossing are children, women, and the elderly, according to the UN. Today, more than 5,000 displaced people made the crossing. Last Thursday, 25,000 people fled Syria in one day, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. Nearly 2 million Syrians have fled the country since violence broke out in 2011. More than 160,000 are in Iraq, and many face severe challenges in camps that lack adequate housing, food, sanitation, and basic services. For more, we're joined by journalist Hermione G. She joins us from Erbil, Kurdistan, where she just returned from a makeshift refugee camp. Welcome, Hermione.
Hi, Dorian.
The makeshift refugee camp you visited is called Kowar Gasht. Describe the place for us.
Well, it's about 20 minutes outside of Erbil, on a hillside on the edge of the town of Kowar Gasht, which is really quite small, just a few thousand people. So it's between Kowar Gasht and the main road into Erbil. It's quite barren, I mean, the area where the tents have been put. But the area itself is fairly agricultural. It's a combination of agriculture and some sort of gas refineries.
And as you said, this is a makeshift camp. It's not a formally organized refugee camp.
It's not formally established. The camp in Dumiz, which has been taking most of the refugees thus far, is massively overcrowded. I mean, they have real problems with sanitation and so on because of the overcrowding. It's roughly holding double the number of people it was built for. So for the time being, they've set up one makeshift camp, the Kowar Gasht, where it was today, where they're sending some of the people who've been coming over in the last few days. And then they've also been sending people to Sulaymaniyah, but there they don't even have a camp. They're sleeping in schools and government buildings and so on.
When you were there, you spoke with some of the refugees. What did they tell you about why they fled Syria?
Well, there seem to be two reasons. Basically, it's security and economy. I spoke with one man, Nave Ramadan, who's 26, who came from the town of Derek 5 days ago.
The security situation was very bad. The PKK was in Derek and Jabhat al-Nusra, in another area not far away. There were car bombings nearby, and we were worried al-Nusra was sending bombs to our town. The price of everything was very high, too. Gasoline was so expensive, we couldn't take a car. Food was unimaginably expensive. I couldn't afford medicine for my child, and no jobs, nothing. It was very bad.
Mazot
That's 26-year-old Nave Ramadan, a Syrian refugee in Kurdistan. Hermione, today aid groups are saying that the Kurdistan regional government has put a cap on the number of refugees that can come across the border. What is the situation at the border for those coming in?
Well, apparently that is not true. There is no quota on the number of refugees being allowed in. The 3,000-person figure is actually a projected number of people they expect each day. Although, in fact, today, from what I heard, 5,100 people came over. So that figure's wrong on that count as well. So apparently there is no quota.
Aid groups have noted a large number of children who have crossed as refugees or have sought crossing. Who are the authorities overseeing these camps, and what kinds of services are available to refugees?
Well, the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government, is playing obviously a very large role in overseeing the camps. So the local authorities are working mainly with the UNHCR. The UNHCR basically takes the lead in all of the refugee camps, and they will work with other NGOs, with other organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières, again, with the local authorities. And in terms of the services that they're provided at Dumiz, which has been in place now for a couple of years and is quite well established, there are a lot of services, obviously the basics, food, water, sanitation, although there are problems with overcrowding. But they have, at this point, they have women's empowerment groups, they have a school, very big school actually, lots of different services. Whereas Kawagosht, where I was today, obviously it's only been there for 5 days. From what I saw today, they do seem to have their basic needs taken care of.
So some of the basics covered for now, but thousands of Syrian refugees coming into the Kurdistan region the last week, according to the UN, the largest migration since the conflict in Syria broke out. We heard a moment ago about the concerns about security that's driving some of the refugees away from Syria. Does this look likely to continue over the next few days?
From what I was told is they definitely expect probably about 4,000 or so tomorrow. They think it will level off after that. But one, Nave Ramadan, actually, who I spoke to, he said that he had heard reports of government bombings of the PKK areas in Syria, which is the Kurdish area where he came from. And he said for that reason, he expects more people to start fleeing. So it's very, very difficult. The UNHCR today, when I spoke to them, said it's just very hard to predict. The large influx that we're seeing right now is in part due to the fact the border between Syria and the Kurdistan region has been closed since May. So there's basically been a buildup of people wanting to cross who couldn't cross. And on top of that, the fact that the border closure has worsened the economic situation in Syria. So people just haven't, as we heard, they have nothing. Food is too expensive. There are no jobs. There's nothing. So for that reason, you're getting more people coming over. So it's very hard to predict is what they were telling me today.
That's journalist Hermione G. in Erbil, Kurdistan, where she's just returned from visiting one of the makeshift refugee camps that is housing an influx of thousands of refugees from Syria. Hermione, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dorian.
This Labor Day, FSRN takes you to the nation's capital for a special documentary.
How about conserving land, water, stopping pollution, and giving food to needy people? You know, this is important.
While elected officials in Congress have long supported big agriculture, a few miles up the road, some D.C. residents are creating an alternative model.
I think until people are able to successfully wrest control over land and over resources away from the profiteering corporations, the sooner we will see something even resembling justice come back into the conversation about how we get our food.
What can decentralized organic urban farming do for local communities? What can it do to address climate change? Find out by listening to FSRN's special documentary, Just Harvest, Urban Farming in a Climate Crisis. That's Labor Day, September 2nd on Free Speech Radio News. In Israel, a proposed law would legalize the displacement of tens of thousands of Bedouins in the Negev Desert. Though the Bedouins are citizens of the state, they say they have not been consulted in a new plan to develop the area, and that the measure would force the agricultural community to move to townships plagued by unemployment and poverty. FSRN's Lena Odgaard reports.
All is quiet in the small village Al-Araqib in the Negev Desert in southern Israel. It's Ramadan and late afternoon, so most of the Bedouins living here are resting before breaking their fast. A group of boys have sought refuge from the sun under a tarp. While roasting coffee beans, 16-year-old Hadi Al-Tori says his family has lived there since before Israel became a state in 1948.
My grandfather lived here, my great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather. The Proverb plan will take our land. They don't want Arabs in Israel.
A proposed law would make it legal for the state to evict Al-Tori and tens of thousands of Bedouins from their land. The law is based on the so-called Proverb Plan, named after Ehud Proverb, chief of the Department of Policy Planning, who headed a team to settle land ownership in the Negev. In connection to the proposed evictions, a new economic plan was recently adopted by the cabinet, which includes expanding industrial zones and investing in housing, culture and recreation. According to critics, these investments happen at the expense of the Bedouin population. Passing piles of rubble, Al-Tori's uncle, 38-year-old Aziz Al-Tori, says the people of Al-Araqib have seen their homes demolished 52 times since July 2010. At the same time, the Jewish National Fund, or JNF, and the Christian organization God TV have planted thousands of trees in the area around the village. On its website, God TV writes that the tree planting is non-political and approved by the Israeli government. But activist groups have called it greenwashing, and as Aziz Al-Tori argues, the aim is to cover up the thousands of Bedouin homes, olive trees and fields that have been destroyed.
They uproot my old trees and destroying my houses and they planting new trees. It means the government used the JNF to kill our life. All of this area, if you show around, we was cultivated it with wheat in winter. We have a job here, we have a business, we work. We have our life so nice, so beautiful.
Al-Tori and the rest of the village have temporarily been allowed to live in a nearby cemetery on their land. But if the law goes into effect, they can expect to be moved into townships. As these are among the poorest cities in Israel, Al-Tori doesn't understand why he must give up what used to be a decent living in agriculture for unemployment in the city. Al-Tori says he has the original documents from when his great-grandfather bought the land in 1905, but his papers as well as the village of Al-Araqib are not recognized by Israel. According to the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, ACRI, an estimated of 180,000 Arab Bedouins live in the Negev. Around half live in villages in the desert. Most of these are not recognized by the state. This means they are not connected to water, electricity or sewer systems. The plan has met heavy criticism from human rights groups for being discriminatory. Condemning the plan on its website, the group Rabbis for Human Rights point to the fact that none of the Jewish Israelis living in the area will be relocated. It writes that instead, the state approves more territory for Jewish settlements and small farms for Jews only, sometimes on the very territory taken from the Bedouin. According to Rabbis for Human Rights, the Negev Bedouins constitute 30% of the area's population. Their claims are for 5% of the land, but a recent poll by the group shows that most Israelis have the impression that the Bedouins are taking over the Negev. Al-Tori complains that the Israeli state and media label the Bedouin community as invaders.
What means that I am now? I begin to be invaders? What about since 1948 until 2010? I was a good man. Now I am invaders. Tomorrow, what, maybe tomorrow the government decides that I am terrorist. I ask my right here. I want to continue my life in my area with the way that I love.
After the law passed its first reading in the Israeli parliament Knesset on June 24th, human rights groups have tried to rally opposition to the plan. In mid-July, in the Israeli city Beersheba, 5 miles south of Al-Araqib, activists and members of the Bedouin community blocked traffic and protested against the plan. Thabit Abu Ras from the Legal Center of Arab Minority Rights in Israel says he welcomes economic development in the townships but criticized the treatment of Bedouin villages.
We are asking that our villages to have the same services and the same opportunities just like the Jewish towns in the Negev. Right now, a Jewish residence of the Negev can live in a city, in a village, in a kibbutz, even some of them individual farms, while the government's trying to impose in the Bedouins only urbanizations. Urbanization doesn't fit the Bedouin life.
The original plan has been slightly altered. It now proposes for a limited time monetary compensation for those with registered land claims and enables recognition of unrecognized villages, but only in accordance to the planning rules. Abu Ras says it still allows for forced evictions of tens of thousands.
Right now, the government of Israel is trying to displace the people into the townships, to somebody else's land, land that is claimed by other Bedouins. 95% of the total area of the Negev is considered as state land. Why the government of Israel cannot decide to establish agricultural villages to the Bedouins in the so-called state land?
The Be'er Sheva rally was part of a campaign dubbed Anger Strike, in which activists participate in demonstrations in solidarity with the Arab Bedouins in cities across Israel, the West Bank and Gaza. The aim is to make it a big enough case that it won't get enough votes for the second reading scheduled for after the summer. Lina Otgor, FSRN, Negev in Israel.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Fire on the Nile. Once again, power is in the hands of the military of Egypt. And once again, the military has distinguished itself by its brutal ruthlessness against Egyptians. They, the armed mainstay of the now fallen dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak, have never accepted nor adjusted to the political rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now we see the hand of their awful vengeance. According to Western accounts relayed from the military dictatorship, hundreds of Egyptians have been slain by the so-called security force. In truth, few outside of Egypt know the real number. It may be in the thousands. Months ago, when Tahrir Square was the epicenter of the Arab Spring, I called the situation Mubarakism without Mubarak. It looks clearer now. Tanks, automatic weapons, and secret police unleashed on Egyptians. A government trying to use state terror to silence legitimate dissent. We've seen this before when Islamic political parties won elections in Algeria. They too were silenced by Western-supported military, determined to use anti-democratic means to form farcical governments. Democracy is a sham in Egypt and beyond. It was trampled under the treads of Egyptian tanks. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Eder. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sites and sounds from FSRN's global reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.